Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
On today's show, we'll be getting some top tips for Christmas reads from Paddy Butler of London's Libreria Bookshop and learning how giving the gift of a book at this time of the year can do a world of good.
We'll also be heading over to Art Basel Miami Beach, hearing from its director, Noah Horowitz, and some of the artists and gallerists making this weekend's event one to remember.
And we'll be hearing from author and translator Yasmin Sil and editor Paulo Lemos Horta, whose new translation of Aladdin looks to enliven the classic tale for new readers.
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's news genie Bill Luthi will be granting us three wishes for the week ahead in current affairs. And we've some great music too on the way, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Fernando, it's beginning to feel a lot like Christmas here at Midori House and further afield.
It's a very special time of the year, Tom, you know? And I'm saying this without any cynicism because I'm going to ask how was your week in a minute. But for me, you know, I love the year-end lists. They start to come out, you know, newspapers, magazines. You know why, Tom? Because the year, we're so busy. I mean, sometimes we don't have time to discover new music or new films. So I do make sure every end of the year I do read the lists and I say which music, you know, I didn't manage to discover. And it's always a magical period, you know, rediscovering the power of music.
So it's magical in as much as it boils down a year of music and films and books and all the rest. But not the sort of magic of Christmas? What about that list? Is he going to be making a list, checking it twice? Well, has Fernando been naughty or nice?
Well, finally, I've been buying some Christmas decorations as well, because last year have been pretty bad. Have you bought yours already, Tom?
A tree. I bought a tree yesterday.
With lights or without lights?
I've whacked some lights on it, yeah. Bit of tinsel, a few snowmen and all the rest of it.
I have lights and tropical birds, actually. That's my new trend.
Is that a Christmas thing?
I mean, if you go around the shops, I think that's kind of a trend. And they have like a lot of parrots and toucans. And they're not even Christmassy birds, but I think that's
Well, they're brightly coloured, which I guess is half the way there. Really, it should be a robin in the mistletoe.
I don't have a robin. I do have two toucans, though.
Two toucans?
No robin.
What's the collective noun for toucans?
I should do some research after the show.
Excellent. See, I told you, we'll be asking the big questions, as always, on the Monocle Weekly. We had the Christmas market at Midori House last week. This weekend, it's moved over. It's been transplanted to Zurich. So the season of goodwill is being felt all through different parts of the planet Monocle, which is very, very jolly. I can sort of almost hear, is that the far-off sound of sleigh bells? Is it Bill Luthi arriving in Studio One?
Which way you're going, Billy? Can I go too? Which way you going, Billy? Can I go with you?
Bill Luthi, here he is. Have you been naughty or nice this year, Bill?
Mostly nice, I think.
Good. Okay. Well, Santa will have a good old rummage in his sack and find something nice for you.
Thank you.
What have you got in terms of next week's news today?
Well, today's news today, this is quite exciting. It's small country elections. Fernando, I know that you're a fan of kind of obscure elections.
I adore. And I think this one's going to be interesting.
But this one's interesting. So it's Armenia. And it's kind of technical to get your head around. So I'll just fly through. Basically, the acting prime minister is sick of not being able to get anything done because the parliament is full of kind of old right-wing politicians that have been running the country for years and years and years. So he's taken a risk. He's stepped down. A snap election has been called. Basically, he's hoping to do what Theresa May was hoping to do last year in this country and kick out all of the old people and win an overwhelming majority. The difference between what he's doing this time and what Theresa May did last year is that he's expected to be successful. So new, fresh blood in the parliament, going to take the country forward. It's exciting.
Because when you said what Theresa May did, I thought you meant send the country careening into the abyss of decade-long
That's not what she was hoping for.
Struggle.
That's what happened.
Yeah, that's what she did do.
And Bill, we should add that actually your desk partner is an Armenian, right?
Exactly. I sit next to Mel Khan.
Have you asked her some of his tips, what he is going to think about the election?
Yeah, well, before I came down here, I just cribbed off him, basically. He's excited for what might happen in his home country. He said, though, that the relations with Russia shouldn't change because the country's so reliant. It's a very small country. It's still reliant on Russia for energy and imports. But he's hoping that within the country, kind of the social policies are moved forward, because a lot of the people are still living in poverty in that country. So hopefully things are going to change for Armenia. If that's not enough for you, head down to Antarctica for the ice marathon. How does that sound?
Now, I am very interested in these sort of bizarre endurance events. When I've been in that chair that you're currently occupying, Bill, as the sort of look-ahead maestro, I would invariably manage to find some of these. Marathon des Sables, the Saharan desert super marathon.
No, thanks.
They're doing 50 miles a day on some days, and they do several hundred miles. This Antarctic one, though, I think, it's a regular marathon distance, is that right?
Normal 26, marathon.
26.2 miles.
Yeah. But exclusively on ice and snow, and only 600 miles from the South Pole. Average wind chill, minus 20.
I think you would enjoy that, Bill, because you do like a little bit of a chill, right?
I do like it when the window's open, yeah. But
that is a level, that's a rung or two higher. The threshold is raised. How many people take part?
I don't know.
We don't know. One would imagine not many. Are there penguins en route?
Yeah, I mean, there'll be wildlife. You might have to. Oh, you don't have to dodge polar bears, do you? Because they're up the north. But there'll be some wildlife.
Dodge some penguins, maybe. Mm. They're quite good, though, penguins. I wonder if human runners down there can do that. You know, if penguins want to cover the ground, they'll flop down onto their bellies and sort of toboggan themselves along. Are you allowed to do that in the marathon?
Presumably on the downhill sections. There's no rules against
that. You'd struggle uphill. There probably aren't that many hills. Am I showing great ignorance there? Isn't it not fairly flat?
Yeah, no, there's like mountain ranges and stuff.
I might skip that one.
Yeah?
It sounds a bit brisk. I prefer to go to the Saharan one, actually.
Okay, well, if that's on Thursday. But the next day, Friday, this might be more your thing, Faye, if you're into languages. It's World Esperanto Day, marked on the birthday of the guy that invented the universal language,
now,
Esperanto.
Is that still a thing?
I think, well, there's a huge like online community, and Duolingo on the language learning app, you can go on there and learn Esperanto. That's up there. Esperanto and like Klingon and some other like made up languages are on there before even Arabic. You'd think Arabic would be on there already, but it's not. I've learned some Esperanto. Do you want to learn some together?
Absolutely.
Okay, well, shall I say the word and then you can tell me what you think it means? This is saluton.
Hello? Well,
that's quite easy. Hello.
Yeah,
because
that's hello.
Saludos or salut, you know.
So it's pretty similar.
Exactly.
Okay, well then maybe this is kill vi vartas.
I want to kill you.
Ooh. No, it's not. It's how are you?
Oh, I'm so sorry.
That's
the
opposite.
Yeah, because it just sounds quite harsh.
Okay, so if you say to me kill vi vartas, Faye, say that to me.
Kill vi vartas.
Mi sentas tre bona.
I feel very good.
I feel great.
Oh, wow. Ooh,
that's good.
I'm
okay.
Liking his lessons.
And then these are the important ones. Okay. Una biron bon volu.
A beer, please.
Got it. And then after you've had a beer, vi belegas.
I'm drunk.
You look hot.
Peleg. I thought peleg, isn't that to do with
the
ocean?
It's belegas with a B.
Ah, I see.
Okay, I find it's pretty straightforward to learn Esperanto.
You'd be all right because it's similar to like kind of European languages, whereas I'm absolutely screwed because all I speak is English.
What a nice selection of stories, Bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. This is the Monocle Weekly. In a moment, we'll be hearing from Paddy Butler about the books to give at Christmas. Don't go away.
Libreria Bookshop in East London is at the forefront of what makes a good store relevant in 2018. Not only is it an attractive and smartly designed space, but it regularly stages events beyond what you might expect of your favourite local literature nook.
The latest of which is an evening of music from Iranian musician Dr. Payman Hedarian and a drive to collect donated books to send onwards to refugees to assist in the learning of English. The event at Libreria takes place on the 18th of December and is a collaboration with Echo 100+. Paddy Butler, no stranger to the Monocle Weekly, runs Libreria, and he joins us once again to discuss not only that event, but some great Christmas reads too. Timeless reads, perhaps, Paddy, but we'll come to that in a moment. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Let's start by talking a little bit about this event. You know, it is a time of year when people are thinking about goodwill to all men and all the rest of it, and it must be wonderful to be able to be part of something like this, which has such a sort of noble ambition at its core.
Yeah, well, look, you know, we've done a lot of things in Libreria in terms of trying to break the mold of what a bookshop can be or what it should be. But Jess Fogarty, she was print artist, risograph print artist with Libreria. And she went down to Greece to work with Echo 100 Plus on Leros. And she just emailed me. She said, guys, we need books down here. You know, people need to learn English. You know, it is something that they're going to require in their onward journey. And I said, look, why don't we do a night of festive music and bring a paperback and donate, you know? So then off the back of that, Galsher, who we work with, she said, look, why don't we really push it out and put on a night of Iranian music? And how magical is that in a bookshop? It's santur music, which is an ancient instrument going back, I don't know, 1300 BC, I think, is the earliest example of illustration of where it's recorded. Santur is, it denotes 100 strings or thereabouts. And I think that's kind of how the instrument is put together. Benjamin Hadarian, like, he's quite prominent in terms of touring that sort of music and showcasing it across the world, kind of a global thing. So it's special that we're hosting this sort of music in Liberia because it has that magical quality, you know, the reflection and the lighting, et cetera, et cetera. But having somebody like Hadarian there and doing his thing is an extra bonus. It's amazing. Yeah.
And we're going to talk a little bit about some, well, I guess they can be Christmas gift suggestions. There's a timeless note to, well, at least a couple of the volumes you've brought in. Are you a firm believer that actually Christmas gift giving, if you're talking about books, it's a good time to go with the classics? You don't have to be always on point. You have to always be up with something new. Sometimes it's best to look back maybe a little.
I think everybody is looking back to go forward in a sense. Like, everybody is looking back to be creative, you know? And what better time to do that than around Christmas? So, yeah, I brought in a couple of things, actually. I was banging my brain, you know, what's interesting? What's magical around this time? And Hans Christian Andersen, I mean, the fairy tales. Oh, my God. You can't do better than that. And they are repackaged by Oxford World's Classics, which a lovely illustration on the front, as you can see, you both see there. And the Brothers Grimm as well, you know. I mean, there's, gosh, what's in there? Let's have a look inside. Hansel and Gretel, bit dark, obviously, for for this time of year. But there's loads of beautiful stuff in there. And I just thought, like, you know, for young children around this time, it is just time to get cozy and explore these beautiful stories, you know. And then you've got George Saunders, who's kind of looking back to the Aesopian fable, has brought out this beautiful book, Fox 8, which is kind of like it is an Aesopian fable. It is an ancient story, but it's kind of set in a modern context, urban context. But the illustrations in it are just...
Well, even the cover art is beautiful, and there's,
isn't it? I love the size of it.
It's a lovely sort of compact little hardback.
Isn't that gorgeous? I mean, like, look at those. Hold on, there's a beautiful.
I'm trying to describe. So they're sort of line drawings that sort of surround the text across spreads, and that's a very, very beautiful thing. That is a lovely stocking filler, isn't it?
Do you know? And it's like, it's reasonably priced, and it's just an overall beautiful package. Like, you know, you could really imagine reading that to your nephew, niece, or daughter, or son, you know? I mean, it's just beautiful. Gorgeous.
And it's interesting, Paddy, because I was thinking, you mentioned actually some of these stories, Grimm's Fairy Tales, Hans Christian Andersen. You know, some of them are quite dark, but apparently this is very important. Mm. In our new sanitised, overly safe world that we live in, the new generations, they're getting sanitised versions even of fairy tales and all the rest. And apparently that's very, very bad. You mustn't take out all of the jeopardy.
Oh, yeah.
It's quite important. So actually...
Totally.
A bit of a, you know, a fright within a secure setting. That's actually a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. If you're idealising it, you know, everything for a young kid, then, you know, you're not, like, preparing them for the reality.
The world's a crazy, crazy place. Fernando, I wonder, in growing up in Brazil... The Brothers Grimm, Hans Christian Andersen, are these
too
truly,
dark. Yeah.
Truly
too
international?
Dark.
Well, we have, to be honest, when I was a kid, I think I read the kind of the sanitized version. But but I do agree. I much rather read, for example, this one as well. But Paddy, I have a question. I mean, you have all these amazing books. I mean, for Christmas season, how do you change the shop? Because I think it's one of the most important seasons, right, for any bookstore. So when do you start thinking, you know, what can you... For example, I bet those books perhaps they will have a better...
Yeah.
standing there at the shop?
Well, you're gearing up for Christmas back in late September. You know, you're looking through, you know, what publishers are putting out, you know, especially cookbooks, that sort of thing, and art books. Because, like, let's face it, everybody loves a beautiful art book, but they like it because during their downtime over Christmas, they can head off to Tate, you know, and explore the riches of Tate. That's what Christmas is about, isn't it? It's about going to these beautiful things, watching what chefs are doing, you know, in the world. Try it yourself, and in my case, make an absolute mess of it. But then go off to Tate and explore the creative potential, what's out there, you know, or the National Gallery. You know,
I was going to say other galleries are available. Sorry, yeah. What about sort of dressing the store? Do you go? Is it you go full Christmas bonanza? Are the books themselves the stars? But is it kind of a middle ground?
It's a bit of a middle ground. I tell you what, like, Tom, you know yourself, like, Liberi is like an art installation in and of itself. So we try and restrain it a little bit, you know, in terms of decoration. But I suppose in merchandising, we've gone out a little bit this year. Like, our kind of curated shelves, author curated shelves, we're kind of beautifying them a little bit, like, just to bring them out. You know, we're using kind of a beautiful red acrylic to kind of reset them, I suppose, you know, and bring them out. But no, I think myself and Sam and Rohan, we've always kind of maintained that Liberia is it. I think if you're overdoing it on the decoration, Liberia, it could go the wrong way, you know.
Paddy, I have a difficult question for you. I mean, because because, you know, books are quite personal. So for the Christmas season, what do you think is best in terms of the etiquette in your world? Should someone actually buy a book and say, you know what, my friend would love this book? Or they should do some sort of, I don't even know if you do that, book voucher or something. Mm-hmm. Like, what do you think is best from your experience?
Well, I mean, it's always nice to get a voucher, isn't it? So that you can go in and explore the place itself, the shop itself. And bookshops are beautiful for that. That's what they're all about. They're about exploring. They're about, and especially in our case, it's about finding new things. It's about serendipity. That's the way we've laid out our shelves. But, you know, it's interesting that you say that, because it comes back to, you know, this evening that we're doing. You know, it's also a time to look, go through your own selection, pick out a couple of paperbacks that you could donate to Echo 100 Plus, you know, and bring it down to the shop, have a nice drink after doing your Christmas shopping, and, you know, give something back. We're in this kind of consumer society, and I think the whole idea of giving back again, putting stuff back into circulation is quite nice, no?
What does Christmas mean to you? What are you most looking forward to about the festive period? Is it time of year that you really look forward to, first of all, I suppose?
Oh my gosh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, 100%. Going back to Ireland, going back to Dublin, all of those things, all of the above, as they say. And then going walking in the country, you know, that sort of thing. Just completely zoning out and yeah, good people, good cheer and books. Sitting down to be able to read finally,
and a nice drop or two as well.
Yeah.
Paddy, it's fab to speak with you. It's a bit early, but have a very Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Likewise.
Good luck with the project, and we'll hopefully a number of our listeners will get along and get involved.
So kind, thank you for having me. And yeah, guys, drop down and let's have a drink.
And that evening of music and literature to aid some of those less fortunate takes place at Liberia Bookshop in East London on the 18th of December. You can head to liberia.io to find out more. This is the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Tom, I was just talking earlier in the show about the power of music. So we're going to have some music now. This is new from the UK's Wave Pictures. It's Goodbye, Spider-Man.
The Wave Pictures there with Goodbye Spider-Man. Super stuff. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Art Basel Miami Beach is wrapping up today in Miami, Florida, of course. The art fair has grown in recent years to become one of the art world's essential stops for finding the freshest new works and most enterprising gallerists.
Monocle's Chiara Remella is there and recently met with the show's director, Noah Horovitz, and also spoke to Mexican artist Abraham Cruz Villegas and gallerist Bree Zucker of Curumán Zotto Gallery about the fair's myriad global influences and the growing importance of Latin American work on the world stage. Here's Noah with more.
I've been with Art Basel now for 4 years. This is the fourth show that I've overseen here in Miami as Director Americas, and the Convention Center has been under renovation for 3 of those 4 years. In that time, we've had the ability to reimagine the show from top to bottom, really from the first time since its inception, or for at least the last decade, in terms of the changes we've made, and we're really happy with them. We now have a show that's extremely balanced with 2 central lounges, great sectors in the corners, 4 entrances, a beautiful building. It's much more fluid. Galleries of all shapes and sizes are much closer to areas of activation and high foot traffic than they've ever been, and that's really key. The quality of presentations this year is exceptionally high. We see extraordinary volume of truly blue chip work. I mean, beautiful Herrings, Rothko's, Picasso, and many others, as well as a lot of emerging artists from all different parts of the world.
What about attendance? Do you have an idea already of what kind of people are coming and how the demographics, perhaps, of people who are coming is shifting? Is that also evolving with the fair?
Well, I think that Art Basel Miami's greatest attribute for the galleries that show here is quite possibly its continued pulling power and bringing new entrants into the market. This is a fair that's really the meeting place of the American creative class. You see people that are in design, fashion, architecture coming through these halls. People that have come into money recently. Successful entrepreneurs, business people in tech, finance, etc., real estate, from throughout the world, of course, but especially in the U.S. and Latin America, really come to Miami as a point of entry into the market. There's a lot of new collectors this year from Chicago, San Francisco, L.A., the Northeast, and so on and so forth. So we're speaking only on, you know, the fair is just open to the public an hour or two ago, so it's difficult to see beyond that, but we feel absolutely confident that it will yet again be the fair that we're seeing a lot of new people coming in, as well as a fair that's got a huge volume of some extraordinary institutional leaders. We had a talk today with Gary Tintero from the MFA Houston, Madeline Grinstein in Chicago, Lisa Phillips, who's the director of the New Museum in New York. So you have great institutional figures, curators, and private collectors of all shapes and sizes. We have a number of galleries this year that are coming from Africa, from Asia for the first time, as well as new galleries continuing to come in from the U.S. and Latin America. Parque Gallery from Mexico City, for example, joins us for the first time. Walden Gallery in Buenos Aires is an extraordinary presentation in our survey sector of Feliciano Centurion, who is one of the highlights of the Sao Paulo Biennial this year. So there's a lot of extraordinary things in the halls. The building also gives us new opportunities. We've had a public sector of outdoor sculpture and installation in Collins Park for the last number of years, a film sector and soundscape park just adjacent to the building. We made a decision this year when we looked at the full spectrum of what we could do with this new facility to wind those down and focus on opportunities and activations in the facility itself. There's a 60,000 square foot grand ballroom that's just come online this year. We're using half of that space to partner with The Kitchen. It's a great nonprofit, of course, in New York, to do a special project. And they brought to us this extraordinary performance by Abraham Cruz Villegas, a Mexican artist who's living and teaching in Paris right now. It's a wonderful project. It's a site-specific adaptation of a performance that came to light originally in Mexico a year ago. The Kitchen brought it to New York last spring, and here it is in a site-specific capacity in Miami.
We're standing in front of one of your works. This feels remarkably small, and I guess compared to what you're going to be putting on at 5, can you tell us about what's going to happen, and can you tell us what it means for you to be given such expansive room, I guess, even physically, as part of this fair?
Well, this work, which is more like an activity, it's a hanging sculpture that we destroy in front of an audience with the help of a group of dancers, choreographers, and musicians. They improvise while the sculpture is destroyed. It was conceived originally with Barbara Fulques, who's an Argentinian choreographer. We worked in Mexico, more like playing together, experimenting, and finding out that we could work together, improvising, me as a sculptor and she as a dancer. And then we ended up like constructing something and not knowing what to do with it at the end. And then we decided to destroy it. And then we called a group of friends to do it in public in Mexico City. Then I was invited to the kitchen in New York to present something there with the long genealogy and tradition of performance there in the kitchen. And then I decided to take this thing to New York. And then we did it during a weekend. We reconstructed after destroying the sculpture with her and with a musician who wasn't able to travel to New York. So he was watching through streaming the destruction. And then he sent us the music via streaming as well. And then now I was invited to do something here. And we decided with Tim Griffin from the kitchen and Philip Kaiser, the curator of the space, the public events here. And then we decided to do it here again, but with a set of three different sculptures with three choreographers and three musicians. And that's what happens here twice per day. It will happen today, tonight at 5 and 7. And the title of the piece, To Insist, To Insist, To Insist. And it's all about identity and the way we destroy ourselves in order to become ourselves. So it's about transformation and the way of making something out of nothing in the worst of the circumstances, let's say, which of course is not about the art fair or not about the art world or not about the place here, Miami, but it's all about more like a human problem, like the way we destroy our environment, for instance, and the way we can still do something out of this destruction. So it's not necessarily like a subject matter, but this is one of the ways of understanding the work.
You mentioned that it's about beyond Miami and it's beyond the specific reality. But regarding where we are right now, do you think this place is symbolic in many ways? Do you like coming here? Do you think the fair has grown into something that is interesting and maturing in its sites as well?
Well, of course, I would say an art fair is not the place for an artist. It's the place for art. But as I'm invited to do this here, I try to challenge myself in order to produce something that is not necessarily a commodity. This way, the work I'm presenting at the Grand Ballroom, as I said at the very beginning, it's more an activity. That, of course, can be for sale. I don't mind. But that's not the main goal of the work, or it's not the unique purpose of it. So it's more about producing some kind of discourse about this, about the way of making art in a destructive way, which is, of course, not new. There is a genealogy for that as well, starting with Gustav Metzger, maybe, with Jan Tangli, with many others. But, of course, it's beyond that as well. It's more about, like, the possibility of using the space and the energy of an art fair, in this case, for having something that could be seen as a critical position, in not about art or not about the art market, but about human, again, about destruction, as I said, and how we can do something with, for instance, materials that for some people could be considered like garbage or things that are dead, let's say, as they are not useful anymore, so they are discarded. That's the way I almost always do my work, like recycling things for giving them a new life that they have already, even without me. But it's more like pointing at this possibility, but in general, like in terms of the world, in terms of the universe, in terms of humankind, in terms of togetherness and being with the others doing something. So that's the way I see this space and moment as nice possibility again. Then I think more and more because of the resources that are meant to be involved in such a place like an art fair or a situation like an art fair, I think it's good also not to produce only commodities. So to produce also, I would say, language, knowledge, questions.
I think people find it more interesting for that matter, no? Surely people come because there's a commercial element, but
I mean, there is this field of thinking that is all about interpretation. It's called hermeneutics. This way, the interpretation is multiplying the work. The way we destroy this work in before an audience, it produces, I hope, many different questions from individuals. So this is something that I still believe in, as with any other artwork. Like we are now in front of a beautiful Jimmy Doran piece that is involving humor, material, language itself, and this is something like any other artwork, hopefully producing more knowledge, more questions, more laughter, more tears, more togetherness again.
My name is Bree Zucker. I am the director of Curry Manzuro New York. When selecting work for Miami, do you put on a Miami head on? And if so, what does that head look like?
Well, we always love representing our family and community of artists. And, you know, it's a constantly organic emphasis on different moments in time as related to the rest of the world. So for us, we're bringing a lot of Mexican, Latin American artists who are part of our program. Here, we really wanted to put emphasis on Abraham Cruz Villegas, especially as he did the welcome reception upstairs with his performance Auto Reconstrucción, To Insist, To Insist, To Insist. He first made that performance at the Kitchen with Barbara Folks just this past year, and now he's doing it every single day of the fair. So it was very important that we have a sculpture by him in the booth, and this amazing pink and green sculpture is by him. It comes from his show at the Kunsthaus Zurich that was just also this past year. And as well as a new work by Lauren Casaria, which is an electromagnetic work, which is related to the crisis currently in Puerto Rico. Also, we have an installation of Gabriel Orozco, works that are both new and more historic. And that is quite a beautiful thing to do because Gabriel was very influential to the beginning of the gallery, so he's always present here with us. So Daniel Guzman, one of the first artists of the gallery, very influential for many of the other artists in the gallery, a master draftsman and a punk guru, in fact. So these drawings, this series, comes from his ongoing work, Chromosome Damage, in which generally the female form is shown mutating, transforming, repositioning itself in all sorts of different feminine guiles. So there's pre-Hispanic deities, there's references to Matisse, there's references to the popular cartoon, Ermelina Linda. So Danielle does it on market paper, traditional crafts paper, traditional market brown paper. And so they have this fantastic quality also as the paper ripples and as these women transform and move throughout time and space.
How have you seen art bars on Miami Beach change, and how you've seen taste change as well?
I think that as the fair has grown, we see a large contingent of Latin American collectors coming from all over the world. And that's really fantastic because the community becomes more vibrant and increasingly there are different audiences present. And that's a very special kind of support that I think Miami is quite focused on. So for us, it's really a celebration, this fair, every year. And that's a fantastic way for us to end, I think.
Do you think that the focus on Latin American artists has also increased over the past of the few years, or has it always been like this, but I guess people are more receptive to it from whatever background they come from?
I would say that as the politics of the world shift, alternative narratives are becoming increasingly important. And people in the traditional centers of the world, such as the market capitals that we know, New York, London, Paris, they are becoming increasingly more interested in learning about other modes of thinking. And Latin America positions itself with a different narrative to a Western narrative. And that, as the times change and as we find ourselves in a very troubling time politically, I think that can be a very powerful educational moment for audiences to interact with.
Bree Zucker there of Curimanzotto Gallery, talking to Monocle's Chiara Ramella. Before that, the artist Abraham Cruz Villegas and Art Basel Miami Beach director Noah Horovitz. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
Tom, it's nearly Christmas time, and you may well be going to a pantomime or watching a feel-good Disney movie to add to the festivities. And a title that crops up again and again within both of those formats is Aladdin, the tale of the boy who released the genie from the lamp.
But the original tale is a far darker and more complex story than the later adaptations might lead you to believe. Now, a new translation of the original folktale is hitting stores. The talent behind it is Yasmin Seal, who's translated the whole of 1001 Nights from its French and Arabic sources, and Paolo Lemos-Horta, who edited the book and was part of the research team that investigated the history of this compelling tale. The two of them have also tried to bring to the fore some of the female voices in the stories, which in some past versions have had less exposure.
Earlier, Monaco's Georgina Godwin spoke to Yasmin and Paolo to find out more.
I grew up with this story. My parents had lived in the Middle East before I was born, and I grew up surrounded by Persian carpets and low trays and pita bread. So when later in college I found out that Aladdin had been a French invention or a pantomime imposture, I was very shocked, and I was sort of determined to say it ain't so. It has to be a real story from the Arab world. So that's really where my long-standing interest in this story comes from.
And how did you come to the story, Yasmin?
Well, the truth is that Aladdin chose me. I was researching a PhD in Ottoman history when I met Paolo, who was looking for a translator, and asked me to retranslate it. I'd grown up in France, so I had studied French literature and then specialised in Arabic and Turkish afterwards. I did a later degree. So this project has brought together those two interests.
Because you're of Syrian descent, you speak so many languages.
My mother is Syrian and my father was British, but his parents were from elsewhere. They were both instinctively cosmopolitan and had grown up around different languages, travelling around, and I think I inherited that view and was lucky enough to grow up around many different languages.
And the same for you, as you're the son of a diplomat.
Yes, so I was born in Budapest and I now live in Barcelona and my life is just a blur of different places.
So look, let's go right back to the beginning with Aladdin. Where do we first see the story emerge?
It was first published in French and there is no Arabic manuscript. The story is published in 1712 as part of Antoine Galland's translation, which came out in 12 volumes, and it was sort of the Harry Potter of its day. There was a sensation after each volume. People would throw stones at his window in the middle of the night and demand a story from the next volume because they couldn't wait. Unfortunately, he did not acknowledge in print where he got the story from. In his diary, his private Parisian diary, he said there was a storyteller from Paris who came and told him some stories, but scholars had not been able to substantiate that. So we've been giving the French translator a lot of credit for 300 years for basically writing the story.
And that isn't true.
Well, it turns out that, thank God, because my childhood would have been a lie, and you know all those games of dress-up would have been even more embarrassing. No, it turns out that Hanna Diab, the storyteller mentioned in the diary, did himself write a memoir, which recently surfaced at the Vatican Library, of all places, as in a bad Dan Brown novel, or a good Dan Brown novel. And Hanna Diab actually wrote of traveling as a very young man from Aleppo to Paris in the service of a bumbling Indiana Jones tomb raider named Paul Lucas, who brought him from Aleppo tomb raiding and then showed him as a curiosity himself in Versailles to the king. So it turns out that he did remember telling stories to Galland to include in The Thousand and One Nights, so that we can now say this is actually a story that an Arab storyteller did bring to the West.
Mm-hmm. Because originally it wasn't in the collection.
Not at all. We unfortunately only have about 282 nights and the manuscript that Galland was translating from, so Shahrazad would have run out of time much earlier. So Galland had to find other places to get stories to fill out the promised 1001, which is almost like infinity, right? This idea that you could keep telling stories beyond the... Think of a number. I can tell you stories for longer than that.
The story has mutated over the years. Mm-hmm. There have been many different versions. And mm-hmm. so picking your way through that, I mean, very complex.
It is very complex. And scholars love to think that maybe there's a Buddhist origin. It's a child saved the dog from being tortured. So then the fish came with a wishing stone and rewarded him for that act. The reality is we don't know why this tailor's son, this indolent, lazy boy who doesn't want to follow his father's profession, whose father dies of grief because he doesn't do so, why is he deserving of the ring and of the lamp and the genies who come with them and the palace and the princess? You know, it's a rag-to-riches story of wish fulfillment, also just of adulthood. He falls in love for the first time. He's growing up. He's an adolescent. So we don't really know why he deserves this good fortune. And there's a lot of mystery surrounding that.
And there's a lot of it told traditionally from a very male point of view, which is where this is such a revolutionary translation, if you like, Yasmin, because finally here are the female voices and you're mm-hmm. really bringing them to the fore in your translation. I think it might be helpful to start off telling us the story of Aladdin.
Aladdin is a very ordinary boy to whom something extraordinary happens. He is a tailor's son. He grows up in poverty. His mother spins cotton to stay alive, the way Shahrazad spins stories to save her own life, and one day forms an attachment to another parental figure, a magician come from North Africa, claiming to be his uncle, and Aladdin follows him out into the wilderness, into a kind of desert. Aladdin is tricked by the magician and betrayed by him and is imprisoned in this vault for 3 days. And eventually, by the power of a ring on his finger, which the magician had slipped to him before letting him go down into the cave. The themes in the story are really about coming of age, losing a parent, becoming attached to another figure, falling in love mm-hmm. with someone outside your social league. He falls in love with a princess. He falls into great wealth and is changed by that wealth and has to navigate that without being corrupted by it, faces various crises that he has to overcome. There are supernatural elements. There is this wish-fulfilling lamp. There is a genie. But in the end, if you remove those fantastical elements, the stories are ones of adulthood, becoming yourself, being tested, overcoming those crises.
And so themes that are just so relevant still mm-hmm. to us today as they were back when it was written. As you say, the story chose you, but one of the reasons is that you do speak Arabic and you speak French and English, obviously. So tell me about stripping back all of the later stories laid upon this and going right back to the original and just telling us what it means. That must have been a very deep process.
Everyone has some idea of what Aladdin is. Some people think it's a French story, some people think it's an Arabic story, many people think it's an American story, a Disney invention. And we felt it was important to allow people to read the text. And by doing so, we're not saying that this is the definitive version or the authoritative version, just that it's the first version to have been written down. And that first version is already a slippery thing and can't be pinned down to one author or to one culture or to one language. So I hope perhaps to complicate readers' sense not just of what Aladdin is, but of this desire for cultural authenticity in the first place. This story has resisted being fixed. The other day I found a Filipino version of Aladdin, which is almost exactly the same, except that instead of collecting a lamp, he finds a tabo, which is a coconut shell cup. And instead of falling in love, he is seduced by a princess and he doesn't want to get married. So I think this story has survived by endlessly changing and reinventing itself. And there are so many different versions in the world. We thought it would be good to let readers actually see the text as it first appeared.
And there's much more of the women in it. Princess, for instance.
The princess is the hinge on which the story turns. She saves Aladdin's life. She uses her ingenuity, her cunning, to save him from the magician who wants to undo him.
I want to turn back to you, Paolo, and talk about the influence of the storytelling culture of Aleppo on the Arabian Nights and just how that really rich Syrian background feeds into these stories, and Aladdin in particular.
And, you know, as Yasmin would agree, Aleppo was itself a very cosmopolitan place. It was a trade centre between East and West. And had Hanna Diab, the storyteller, never left Aleppo, he already would have been exposed to the Italian stories via the priests who were there, the French stories. He apprenticed with a French merchant. There were over 60 cafes in Aleppo at the time. We know from historical accounts that people would go and pay for a cup of coffee and stay for the story. And in fact, that there was an attempt to rugby tackle the storyteller to make him finish his story before he was able to leave, because the cafe owner wanted you to come back the next day and pay another coffee so you could listen to the next story. A little bit like Shahrazad in a way. We know that there were Christians and Muslims together in some of these cafes. We know that there were even some prohibitions against some of the mixing. The Maronites weren't very happy that this was happening. We know there were even some Christian storytellers. So there was a kind of mingling of Jewish, Christian, Muslim storytelling going on at sometimes less peaceful, sometimes more peaceful coexistence between these communities.
Yeah, because in fact, the Jews don't come out particularly well in this book, do they?
No, and in many ways, this is a classic piece of 18th century French prose with its charm and its wit and its bigotries. Anti-Semitism is a common feature of French writing of that period, and we can't hide that.
And so when you're translating something like that, which nowadays absolutely isn't politically correct in any way, what's the temptation? I mean, do you fix it or you just go with how it was?
The story went through many different versions. We went back and forth about what to do. At one point, the draft was about two-thirds shorter, I think, and we thought we'd do an abridged version or a retelling. But in the end, we felt, because the story is not available, there is no translation that is accessible as a single volume edition, we felt the thing to do is really to present this text to readers with some context and introduction. and let them make up their own minds.
Mm, and of course, the introduction is written by you, Paolo. Mm-hmm. And you talk about the sort of later versions. You're talking about people like T.E. Lawrence, Kipling, or even the explorer, Richard Burton, mm-hmm. and the prejudices, I suppose, that they bring to this.
That is really the problem. And I think that's why I would push back against this idea that Aladdin was invented by the Panto. I mean, I've done a lot of research. We're now both working on this new edition of the Arabian Nights. I need a lot of illustrations. And what a surprise to see that before the Panto, Aladdin was already very popular in stage versions. Before the late Victorian imperialism, there are a lot of versions of Aladdin which was Aladdin in France or in London and stripped of the exoticism that we associate with the story. So I think it's very unfortunate that we imagine that the Disney or the Panto versions are the ones that gave us the story. In fact, what we have, for example, are the diaries of maids who memorized a story, went out into villages, told the story of Aladdin, and then a generation later, you see these oral versions that came from the version she had read in the Galland version. And it was incredible how disseminated the story was in the early 18th century, before the high imperialism of France or of Britain.
And of course, it's to be disseminated further now in your version.
Yes. The most popular genre of fiction in France, just before this story is published, are fairy tales, mm-hmm. the conte de fées genre, which mimic the structure of the knights in many ways. They are fairy tales, they often include female narrators, they're filled with magic. So this was already something that everyone was reading.
It's resonated so closely that Marina Warner and others have imagined, well, it must have been the French translator who invented Aladdin, because the rags to riches theme, the talismans, the curses, all seem to match what was already in French literature at the time. It just so happens that actually now that we know that Diab told the story, it did come from the Arab world, we go back and go, oh, actually, all these elements are also in these Arabian Nights stories, and we shouldn't just think of them as things that happen to be French.
Yeah. Now, you have to know, we've talked about political correctness, but also there's just our attention spans, and one has to be cognizant of how a modern readership actually consumes literature. And you've really done that, haven't you? I mean, the way you've structured the book.
We made the decision to divide it up into chapters to mimic the different stations, you could call them, that Aladdin goes through on this coming-of-age story. He is a kind of everyman, and he goes through important moments of crisis and discovery and realization. The story is really one of education. He learns about the true value of things. He learns to tell false jewels from real jewels. He educates his eye and his moral compass.
We have wonderful versions of the Arabian Nights, but for some reason they're always in these big, bulky, fat 18th century paragraphs. And the reality is, in the Arabic, the stories that we do have in Arabic, there are no paragraph breaks. So why should we preserve that one form of writing? Some critics have found it difficult to find when a character enters or dies or the climax of a story in the Arabian Nights because of this convention. What we've done is also break up the paragraphs in a more natural way for the contemporary reader who might be reading The Maze Runner or Hunger Games, you know, books in some cases with similar themes, actually. And we've also popped up the dialogue in a way that would be natural for a reader today. Mm. And why not? There's no reason why we should be preserving an 18th century convention today.
Yasmin Seal and Paolo Lemos-Horta speaking to Georgina Godwin there. And their new translation of Aladdin is in all good bookshops now. You're with The Monocle Weekly. There you have it, Fernando. Some Christmas cheer and some other fun, as always. That's what we're serving up this Sunday lunchtime on edition 492, count them, of The Monocle Weekly.
Almost 500.
We are ticking towards the 500,000 mark. Definitely still very much the sort of festive spirit in the air, and we'll have more of that sort of thing over the next couple of weeks as well.
Absolutely, cannot wait.
Let's thank our friends behind the glass. The programme was produced by Tom Hall and our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. We'll be back at the same time next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, Tom Edwards.
And from me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Goodbye. Bye.